Welcome on to the Dunkdown Basketball Podcast, where I am still wiping some egg off my face, having tweeted early on in tonight's Rockets-Clippers game to wake me up when Chris Paul isn't injured anymore. And from that moment on, the Clippers started playing much better. They'd been down about 10 through the midway point or so of the second quarter, and they came back to what ended up being a comfortable victory over the Rockets. So, Danny, we've now seen three of the four road teams have won game one of the second round series. Each series has a game in the books. How would you rank those teams' chances of ultimately pulling out the series?
So, to me, you have to start with the teams that where the home team doesn't have a full complement. And so, for me, the most likely is the Bulls, just because we haven't seen the Cavs without Kevin Love. So, I think they're most likely to do it. I guess between the other two, I would say that the Rockets... Oh, so we're talking about pulling that series. So then the Clippers would be second, and then the Wizards would be third. But you could talk me into any order. They're all close in that range, but I would have the most confidence in the Bulls because we're not going to see a complete Cavs team.
Yeah, and we won't even see J.R. Smith back until Game 3. Otherwise, we'll get into it. I think actually he will make an enormous difference with some of what ailed the Cavs today. But in the meantime, I would say I would definitely rank Washington last still. I think that just the Hawks, much like in the Brooklyn series, had their shots, weren't necessarily hitting them, and also a lot of their problems could be solved by, as we'll get to, a little better player usage. I would then say that the Clippers have the best chance with Paul theoretically coming back, whether he plays in game two or whether now having gotten a game they decide to sit him and give him a little bit more rest. That would be another option for them. But I think with him being at full strength and them now having stolen the home court advantage, I think the Clippers are a little better team than the Rockets. A lot of my pick for Rockets in seven was that Paul would be limited or out, and the Rockets had home court, and now neither of those things is so much of a factor after the Rockets kind of blew this opportunity. And then the Bulls, certainly some disturbing things in this game for Cleveland, but also I think that they played extremely poorly, and the Bulls got lucky to some extent. So we'll see what happens in those series, but that would be my ranking, I think.
Yeah, I that's definitely fair. But, yeah, I mean, it was funny to me how I was originally thinking about certain components of the logic with the Clippers-Rockets series the same way that I thought about the Memphis series, which is that if their star point guard missed the first two games, it's incredibly hard to win 4 out of 5. And now the Clippers don't have to do that at all. They might even turn that the other way on the Rockets. I don't think they are. I think they're going to sit Chris out. But what I wanted to ask you before we really get into the games is, if you were Doc Rivers right now, what would you do with Chris Paul in game two?
Well, it depends what the medical personnel says, obviously, and what Chris himself says. Hamstrings are the type of thing that are... Hamstrings and calves, really, I think, are the two injuries that are most prone to being re-injured. Maybe you could throw in, like, abdominals in there as well, but the type of thing where, as we talked about a little bit on yesterday's show, where you need a hamstring to do basically anything, and any type of explosive movement, a hamstring is the type of thing where when it feels better, then you need to wait, you know, even longer before you really get back out there. You see guys re-injure hamstrings all the time. Paul has had that happen to him previously. He had such a history with his hamstring. So I think even if he feels 100%, which he clearly didn't if he wasn't going to play in this game, even if he feels 100% for game two, I might either, you know, play him pretty short minutes and kind of see how the game is going. And you know, if something's going really poorly, maybe you shut him down or you just hold him out again. I think I would probably lean towards the latter course, because if he wasn't good enough to go today, there's no way he's fully healed by game two. And while he might be able to gut it through game two, you're always risking aggravation and re-injury of something like that unless you let it get as close to fully healed up as you possibly can.
Yeah, and another option to kind of hedge a little bit, if they wanted to do this, obviously I agree with you that the doctors are important, is that the Clippers don't play 12 guys. And they could conceptually dress him, maybe in Jordan Hamilton's spot, and then just not intend to play him. And you see how he feels in the layup line and everything else, and so you consider him active in that sense. But you do it without the intention of bringing him in the game unless you absolutely need it and he feels ready.
Yeah. All right. Well, so why don't we talk about that Clippers-Rockets game that just finished up. What are your 10,000-foot thoughts there?
The Rockets needed to play better. I mean, you could talk about how there were things that were correctable. See,
you can only get that kind of insight here on the Dunked On Basketball podcast.
Well, what I mean by that is there were, you could talk about the effort component of it, but what kept on shaking in me was the turnovers. Was that this was a game where if you don't make that many mistakes and you force the Clippers to beat you, you force Austin Rivers to take shots, you force Matt Barnes to take shots, you're probably going to do pretty well. And they didn't do that. And it was very frustrating. It was one of the more frustrating games that I can remember for me, partially because I picked the Rockets and partially because I always have that issue with certain teams that it's kind of like when you feel they can be doing so much better than they are doing, even though I'm a relatively unathletic person, that just bothers me sometimes. And this game was an example of that.
You know, Houston, for me, this was a return of all of the questions that we had about them almost going into the season, frankly. You know, we wondered about how good their defense was, and they were sixth in defensive rating this year. Those questions were somewhat alleviated. Harden tried a little bit harder on D. You know, they got a little bit better of a system. They got some new coaches in there to help out defensively. And they looked a lot better. James Harden struggled in the last two playoffs. Great regular season. Number two in the MVP, probably deservedly so. And they had trouble at power forward. They signed Josh Smith. Terrence Jones improved a lot. Dwight Howard had some health issues, but now is looking great. And then they steamrolled over the Mavericks. But, you know, that wasn't really a real NBA defense in that first round, and they're pretty decimated even, you know, without Parsons on the offensive end as well. And they still end up getting scored on pretty darn well by that Mavericks team once they decided to end the Rondo experiment. But we still didn't see enough of Houston to really know what they were going to be. And I think even in picking them in seven, I probably got seduced. I tried not to, but I got seduced a little bit more by that first round series than I should have against what was really a shell of a team. So all those bugaboos are back now. No Paul. They give up 117 points on about 118, or I'm sorry, on about 108 possessions in this game. A very fast, or at least high possession game. They throw the ball over the gym. Harden, not really very effective at all. In his isolations, wasn't able to get to the line as much. And he had 9 turnovers, so driving into a crowd a lot. So he wasn't able to be as effective as he was in the regular season. His defense also, Matt Barnes, who, you know, certainly played a great game, but, you know, not exactly a one-on-one scorer, had 20 points, mostly by taking advantage of Harden's off-ball lapses. So it was really a big-time regression from Houston, and I think a performance that reminds you of some of the questions that they had going back to last year that maybe were never solved after all.
And if you want to think about some of the stereotypes of the Rockets were that kind of went by the wayside in this game, the Clippers made more threes than the Rockets in this game at a higher percentage. That's why they did. The Rockets took more. The Clippers made more. And the Clippers made substantially more free throws. They made 22. The Rockets made 14. And if you're thinking about particularly a game where Chris Paul didn't play, those are areas that the Rockets should have had some advantages. And They didn't press those, and then, you know, if you want to talk about turnovers and fast break points and all that. But I mean, it's hard to feel good about Houston, except for the fact that they can play so much better than they did today, which is absolutely true.
Yeah, Dwight Howard had a pretty nice game offensively, 9 out of 13, 22 points, so he was only 4 of 9 from the line. had some big highlight blocks and was actually really in Blake Griffin's head by the fourth quarter when Dwight was guarding DeAndre. He was able to get in there on Blake's post-ups and get a couple blocks on him and a couple of intimidations while still preventing the pass from going to Jordan due to his athleticism and his just sense of timing and angles to prevent the pass and contest the shot. So Howard played pretty well, but a lot of the turnovers didn't really help. The Clippers were able to take advantage on those, although, you know, Houston didn't really have any more turnovers than the Clippers did. Houston wasn't really able to take advantage on their own fast breaks nearly as well, it seemed like. So that was, I'm trying to look at points off turnovers right now. I guess
it was the Clippers scored 34 points off turnovers and the Rockets scored 21. So yeah, you're right.
So that's the eye. The stats actually back up what we saw with the eyes then, because both teams had 14 steals. You know, it wasn't like there were a lot more dead ball turnovers that the Rockets were getting. They just weren't able to convert on those live ball turnovers the way the Clippers were, which is really disappointing for the Rockets. So maybe they'll play better. They missed a lot of open threes, although they don't really have any amazing knockdown shooters on that team either. So I don't know. What do you think? Are the Rockets sure to play better, or is this something where they're really in trouble?
Well, I think that Dwight played great. And as you said, one of the aspects that makes Dwight such a special defender is that he can strike the balance that he did with DeAndre and Blake in this game. And I think he can do that frequently. And so that's something. But Harden wasn't, I don't think he was assertive enough. And there were also a few possessions where, like, the one that stuck in my brain was he was the only defender in a 4-on-1. And what he did was he kind of defended it and gave up an and one and a clean look to Blake. It wasn't like he took away the shot by committing the foul. And so, you know, you can clean up some of those types of things. And the challenge for them, though, is they can play better, but the Clippers will almost definitely have better talent on the floor. You know, like, it's hard to think that Austin Rivers is going to be playing 28 minutes in that many more games. So they have to press that advantage while they have it.
Now, Rivers did actually do some good things.
Sure.
4 out of 6 on threes. Total, he had 17 points on 14 shooting possessions, so one of his more efficient performances. He also had 4 steals, 3 turnovers, but, again, not great defense from him. The rest of the Clippers starters were all, almost plus 20, and Rivers was plus 2, and I think that was reflected in his performance. Crawford played a lot of time at the point, which worked out really well for the Clippers also. He had a nice game with 21 points on 19 shooting possessions. And another thing that was huge for the Clippers in the second half was that J.J. Redick was actually able to get loose, and he didn't do much in the first half. I think he only had 2 shot attempts in the first half, and he was able to get up 11 shots in the second half. He was being guarded primarily by Jason Terry, who did about as well as could be expected, especially in the first half, but doesn't quite have the length to contest JJ. He was getting there. He was able even to get a hand up, right in between JJ's hands on a lot of these shots, but JJ was able to shoot right over him, being a little bit taller, and Terry, can't really jump much anymore either. So they had what their plan was to put Ariza on Austin Rivers, and then when Rivers would run a pick and roll, they could switch that, and Ariza would be able to guard Blake or DeAndre on the switch. But I think I would go with Terry on Rivers, let Rivers run pick and roll, get in the lane, and if he beats you with his floaters that he doesn't shoot very well on, so be it. I think I would go with Ariza on Redick or on Crawford when he's in, try and take that away a little bit more.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. And yeah, and it's a challenge because obviously Harden has done better on defense this year than in previous years, but you still don't trust him on Reddick, to be sure.
Yeah, no, that would be a disaster, especially just from an energy standpoint.
And I also...
Harden's got to guard Barnes. He just has to do a better job.
I also think that this was a fun example, in a way, of the idea, something that I harp on a lot, is that your position is who you defend, and how that reflects itself in this series is that you can defend Jason Terry with the two. You don't have to put a point guard on him. And so if you have guys like Jamal Crawford that have the ability to handle the ball and the ability, you don't necessarily want him running your offense, but you can use those kind of non-traditional lineups against this Rockets team because they're not going to force the advantage that traditionally playing a point guard forces.
Blake Griffin had an unbelievable game.
Yes.
13 assists. And I thought about this before the game, especially with Rivers, a guy who's a kind of a combo guard. Reddick, not a guy who works off the dribble a ton. Matt Barnes, not a guy who works off the dribble. Clippers did not really have many guys who could dribble the basketball, and Blake was able to work out in transition. He got a lot of outlets, a lot of grab and goes, was able to work on pick and roll, post-ups, whatever it was, and then just playmake and find guys. And the Clippers were able to get 31 threes up. They made 13 of them. A lot of those assists were Blake finding guys out on the perimeter. So he was unbelievable. And, you know, he did have 5 turnovers, but despite that, you know, another 8 for 10 performance from the line, another great performance for him from the line, 26 points total for Blake Griffin. And you'd have to say he's the primary reason why the Clippers won this game. He was the engine that allowed a lot of their supporting guys to get off.
Absolutely, and when he's having as large of an offensive role as he had in this game, I think you tolerate the 5 turnovers. He's not Chris Paul in that sense, and so he was doing a great job of also, you know, helping get everybody involved and also getting the Rockets uncomfortable. He drew some good fouls, and he was huge. He was the best player on the floor tonight, even though Dwight had a really good game.
What do you think about the way Mikhail used his guys? Would you have played anybody more or less than he did? I think it's pretty much about what I would have done. I mean, Corey Brewer did not have a good game. He was 3 out of 12, 0 of 5 on threes, but he played 24 minutes. Prigioni was pretty good. Jason Terry shot just fine, too. I mean, neither of those guys are amazing, but if you can get the production out of them that they got, 21 combined points out of those two guys, you're certainly very happy to have that. Josh Smith was 3 out of 12, but the problem was that Terrence Jones wasn't any better offensively, and he can't pass the way Smith can, and he also doesn't defend. Smith at least was okay defensively, but not great either. So that power forward position, really a big problem for the Rockets. Combined 4 out of 18 for those two guys. Really not a good power forward performance, and they missed Demo tonight.
Yeah, they really did miss him tonight. And in terms of the minute distribution, I had no real problems with it. I would be hesitant to play many minutes without Dwight or Clint Capella on the floor. They had a couple minutes in this game with that. But other than that, I think that was more towards the end, if memory serves, that it was more when the game was kind of out of control. But yeah, I mean, with the Terrence Jones, Josh Smith dynamic, it's just whoever's playing better. And in this game, Josh Smith was a much better player, so you play him more.
Yeah, the Clippers did very well to make the guys shoot who weren't going to hurt you that much. Like, for example, that 4-5 pick and roll elbow get that the Rockets run with Smith and Dwight Howard has gotten a lot of attention. And the way the Clippers dealt with that was they switched it, but then they had the man guarding Smith, who had been guarding Howard, lay way off and just forced Josh to shoot the jumper. And then that worked well to defend that play. So that was useful. So forcing Smith to take 12 shots, Corey Brewer to take 12 shots, and Smith 1-5 on threes, Brewer 0-5 on threes. Those are the guys you want shooting those shots if you're the Clippers. So they had a really nice defensive game plan in this game. They were really able to crowd on James Harden. And as Mike Preda pointed out from SB Nation, they were able to close out to guys at the 3-point line, force them to put it on the floor, which most of those guys aren't great at. and those guys weren't able to make a play, you know, whether it was Ariza, whether it was Prigioni, Corey Brewer, whatever, they weren't able to make a play when, even when there was a hard closeout flying at them at the three-point line.
Yeah, I think you have to give the Clippers players and their staff a ton of credit because they were very well prepared for this game. They knew what they wanted to do. And as you said, the other important thing in any series, and this is you see this a lot in the NBA, is knowing who can hurt you and how they can hurt you. And so forcing Trevor Ariza to dribble is a good thing if you're defending him. And they had that with a couple other guys. With Corey Brewer, I mean, you can just use his infinite confidence against him offensively. He's a very talented player, but he has more faith in his jump shot than he should. You see that around the league. It's not an uncommon problem. But the Clippers did a magnificent job, I would even give them that credit, to make the Rockets do the things that they didn't want to do, but they were going to do because that's how those guys are wired. You know, Josh Smith is going to take those shots, so you let Josh Smith take those shots, and sometimes they're going to go in. You know, people talk about this as a make-or-miss league, but you want to give those shots to the guys who are going to miss them more than they're going to make them.
All right, why don't we move on to tonight's other game then, and that's Chicago at Cleveland. Chicago with a 99-92 victory, which was actually a very efficient offensive game. This was an incredibly slow game in terms of the number of possessions. You know, ended up, I think, about around 85 or so possessions. And so efficient offensive games for both teams, but especially the Bulls. What were your thoughts watching this one?
There were a lot of them. I mean, do you know how Mirotic's health is? That was actually the first thing I thought of was, I kept on thinking about how could be such a huge factor in this series, and then he played 2 minutes.
I mean, he played in games 4, 5, and 6 of the Bucks series, so it didn't look particularly right to me, but he's also had some more time off. I think he's okay. I didn't see much from him in his 2 minutes on the floor to indicate there was much wrong with him at this point, but you know, I mean, I think Thibodeau has the way that he likes to do things, and that's starting knowing Gasol together, which actually worked out okay, as it turned out. And then, you know, he kind of trusts Gibson more, and I think going to Mirotić is something that he'll do when it's not quite working out as well. You know, I mean, you've seen the games that Mirotić will close, it's usually when they're down. You know, when they were in that game 4 and game 5 against the Bucks, Mirotić got a lot of time at the 4 closing those games because he felt like they were down and it wasn't working. But, you know, Coach Sibbs, when his traditional stuff is working, he'll just stick with that. Even, you know, it doesn't really enter his mind that, all right, something else might be working even better than this, so maybe I should give that a shot as well. You know, and I don't know, I think that said, a lot of guys played really well for the Bulls.
Yep.
Starting with Pau Gasol, really, who led the offense for them.
Yeah, Pau played really well. Jimmy Butler had his stretches. I was a little bit worried when he rolled his ankle on, I believe it was LeBron's right foot on a play. But the other storyline in this game, and we'll have to see if J.R. Smith can be enough to do it, is that the Cavs needed one more rotation guy that they trusted, and they tried Mike Miller. Really didn't work. They tried James Jones, didn't really work any better. Marion didn't get many minutes, but he didn't play super well. So I was shocked that it was Dellavedova that they decided on was the fifth guy. And I've watched Dellavedova for a while because I'm from the Bay Area and he went to St. Mary's. And I'm happy for the guy. I wanted him signed by various teams as an undrafted free agent. But to be that guy in this series when you already have Kyrie Irving and LeBron dominating the ball, it was... I'm not going to say it was a bad move because nobody else was objectively better, but it was jarring.
Yeah, I think one place to start is with LeBron. Not a fantastic game for him from a scoring perspective. He did have 9 assists, but 6 turnovers, 19 points on 23 shooting possessions, so very inefficient, and only got to the foul line twice where he was 1 of 2. Did have 4 offensive rebounds, which is not an area he typically contributes in. Jimmy Butler did a very nice job on him. Offensively, really the only way LeBron was able to get good shots when he did was just by backing down, backing down, backing down in the post. And the Bulls eventually adjusted to take that away by bringing another man over to the strong side. And the Cavs just were one shooter short in this game, coincidentally with J.R. Smith being suspended and obviously with Love being out. You know, when you've got Dellavedova, who's an okay set shot three-point shooter, but not a guy who's going to hurt you on a closeout. Shumpert ended up taking 10 three-point shots, some of which were not, it was 4-10, but some of those were not amazing looks. And Irving even was only 1 out of 5 from behind the three-point line. Jones, 0 of 2. So the Cavs need to get more production from the three-point line. But another issue, too, outside of the lack of shooting, is just the lack of imagination, I think, it came to the fore. And when you're just ISOing all the time, that's exactly what Thibodeau's defense is designed to take away. You've got a good individual defender on LeBron and Jimmy Butler, someone who LeBron is not going to be able to get a clean look on just in a straight ISO the way he can on most guys. And that's the big difference with Miami is LeBron would get the ball on the move a lot more. He would get the ball after a ball reversal. And that's not actually the way LeBron as a default likes to play. He likes to play with the ball in his hands. And that's now that he's kind of running things again in Cleveland, they haven't been running Coach Blatt's offense from Europe. They've been giving him the ball, but that doesn't work that well. They need to move the ball and get him the ball in positions where he hasn't been holding it for 10 seconds against an actual good team. That worked great against Boston. Maybe it'll even still work against the Bulls, but for tonight it did not.
And on the other end of the court, it seemed to me like the way the Cavs were defending the pick and roll went right into exactly what Chicago wanted, or they countered really quickly, because that was part of what was getting Powell and Derrick Rose so many good looks.
Yeah, they switched up a little bit. They were much more effective on that in the fourth quarter, where they actually would switch Tristan Thompson on, and Rose got stymied a couple times there down the stretch. Butler made a really tough shot in the lane. At least he actually tried to drive Thompson. Part of the problem, of course, was that Thibodeau was playing security blanket Kirk Heinrich down the stretch, which we can talk more about later. But, in that third quarter, whether they went with two bigs or they went with one, you got to have the center guarding Gasol because of his post-up ability. And Derrick Rose was able to get in the lane. Kyrie Irving was guarding him. And once Rose was able to get around the pick, which Irving is not good at staying attached to Rose, Rose could accelerate, force help from the big man. Pau Gasol just wide open on jumper after jumper in that third quarter, and his jumper was absolutely wet tonight too.
Yeah, it made a lot of sense for them, and I feel like considering I know you have strong feelings of, we should talk about the Kirk Heinrich thing. I mean, it was, again, I'll use the word jarring again, to see that Thibodeau's going back to that well again, even though I think pretty much all of us know that it's not the best way to do it.
Yeah, so let's finish up here on the Cavs defense before we get to the Bulls, because, sure. It's, as much as I would like to make the Bulls player usage the story, I have to admit I was getting into this game a little bit. Scared the cat away as I was yelling at the TV about that terrible charge that LeBron took on Derrick Rose.
I was going to bait you into that.
About 8 seconds after he released the ball, and he was still sliding under him even after he'd released the ball to get the call. Someday we'll do a whole episode on why the charge needs to be reformed, but we can save that for the dog days of August if this podcast is still around by then. But defensively for the Cavs, I thought that the way they were going to match up, especially if they're starting Shumpert, I was very encouraged that they were starting Shumpert, and then they were still starting small with Mike Miller, was that they would go with Shumpert on Derrick Rose, and then put Kyrie on Dunleavy, and have LeBron then guard Jimmy Butler, and put, whoever would be Mike Miller probably, have him guard Joakim Noah. But that's not the way they went. They went with LeBron most of the time on whoever that second big was for the Bulls. And I'm not sure. And they had Butler guarded by Shumpert, and that left Irving on Rose. And Rose, for those first three quarters especially, was able to really make a lot of hay against Irving that I'm not sure he necessarily could against Shumpert. So I'm not sure whether the rationale there was LeBron would just be too tired to guard, have to guard Butler, who of course is a threat now, and also fulfill his offensive responsibilities, or whether they felt that was legitimately the best matchup and they were worried about the four-man hurting them, and so LeBron had to guard that guy. But I think there's a lot more value added to getting Shumpert onto Kyrie and LeBron onto Jimmy Butler and see how that works. Let that four-man for the Bulls, whether it's Noah or Taj Gibson, be the one to try and kill you posting up against someone like Mike Miller, or especially if you're going with the two big lineup, which we saw some of going in that direction. What did you think of the way Cleveland decided to match up in this game?
You and I talked before this series started, once we knew about the suspension, that one of the silver linings was that that Blatt would be able to try Shumpert on Derrick Rose, and then we didn't see it. You know, like it was kind of like we kind of sat there and went, okay, that's what's going to happen here. And Kyrie Irving is many things, and a good pick and roll defender is most certainly not one of them. And it seemed to me like you're setting him up in a situation to fail. And while I wish that he was better at that, at a certain point, you have to take it as kind of a fait accompli, at least this season. And so you work with that, and so you put him, as you said, on somebody like Dunleavy, or maybe for certain stretches on Butler, or obviously on Kirk Heinrich whenever Kirk Heinrich's on the floor. And they didn't do as much of that, and I think that understanding your weaknesses in many circumstances is as important, or maybe even more important, than understanding your strengths. And this entire Cavs season, to me, has been a lack of appreciation, a maximization of either end of that spectrum. You know, they didn't use a lot of Kevin Love's best abilities when he was on the court. They haven't used Amon Shumpert's amazing guard position versatility. Because
the funny thing to me was, though, like, they had Shumpert on Isaiah Thomas the entire first round, basically. And so that's why I assumed that they would continue with that approach. But I guess the thinking was, all right, we need Shumpert to guard Butler. But I don't think Shumpert is a great matchup on Butler either, because Shumpert really, in my opinion, is better on smaller guards. Shumpert is not the strongest guy. Butler can kind of overpower Shumpert a little bit and has the height advantage, so he can shoot over him. So I think Shumpert provides so much more value added guarding Rose than he does guarding Butler.
Yeah, Shumpert's a guy who you guard down with him, meaning that you guard, so he has the size and strength advantage, whereas Butler's a guy that you kind of want to do the same thing. You want to have somebody a little bit bigger on him, which is why I think we both thought LeBron would be the logical pairing in that circumstance. And yeah, again, it's a misunderstanding of strengths and weaknesses. Why I like Shumpert is I think that he's particularly useful in that. And considering the teams that are left in the playoffs, he's a very useful defender with a lot of the teams, especially if the Cavs were to make the finals. And so I think you have to embrace what he does well, and that it ties so well in with Kyrie Irving's deficiencies. And I think we'll see it, but it was frustrating not to see it in Game 1 because their margins were so tight without J.R. Smith.
Two more points before we need to move on to the other two series. The Cavaliers were 2 out of 17 on above the break threes, and they shot 5 out of 9 on corner threes. I thought that that is very indicative of the type of shooters that they have on the floor, where guys like Dellavedova, a guy like Shumpert, those guys could make corner threes pretty well. But once you get them above the break, they're not going to be able to hit nearly as well. And that limit, having to stick those guys just in the corner, limits a lot of your versatility offensively. Also, a lot of that 2 out of 17 was off the dribble threes from LeBron and Kyrie, which they were not able to hit perhaps at their usual clip, but those are tough shots, especially against a team like the Bulls. So that, and then from the Bulls' perspective, there is a concern that this victory could be fool's gold. I mean, you had Rose play for the first three quarters at least about as well as you could hope. Mike Dunleavy was excellent. Pau Gasol was excellent. But you also had Coach Thibodeau going with Heinrich, not playing Tony Snell, not playing Mirotić at all. Joakim Noah played 28 minutes, 0 of 4, was not really, and had 4 turnovers as well, was not able to really have much effect at the rim, especially in the third quarter. And Gibson and he and Gibson were the tandem to start the fourth quarter, And Thibodeau had Rose, Butler, and Gasol all out of the game at once. The Bulls weren't able to score much in that fourth quarter until the very end. So that enabled Cleveland to come back. You remember the Bulls were up really throughout most of the game by double digits. So still some concerns here for the Bulls. And you worry that they maybe really should have won this game with Cleveland's rough shooting performance, only 7 out of 26 from the three-point line. They should have won this game by more, and that the player usage issue may still come back to bite them. I hope that it doesn't, but it's a concern. I mean, they shot 10 out of 18 on threes and really only won in a pretty close game.
Yeah, I would say they did what they needed to do. They needed to get at least one of the two J.R. Smith games, but I didn't watch this game having a ton of confidence that they were the team to beat in this series. I thought they did what they needed to do, and that's huge, because if they had lost this game, it would have been devastating, but they didn't establish themselves in my eyes.
One positive note for the Bulls, we expected them to get killed on the boards. They were able to get 31 out of 42 defensive rebounds, so not too bad. Kept the Cavs under 30% on the offensive glass, and that at least you can get by with. There were some offensive rebounds for Thompson and Mozgov, but nothing that was so unmanageable for the Bulls. So that's encouraging for them. All right, why don't we move on now to Washington and Atlanta. This game was yesterday. We didn't get a chance to talk about it because we did that long Clippers-Spurs podcast yesterday. What did you think of this? Are you in agreement that Atlanta is not in too much trouble here, or are you more concerned?
I'm a little bit concerned because the Wizards are playing up to their ability, but I think the story was, again, Mike Budenholzer, his managing of Al Horford's minutes when he was in foul trouble. Do you agree?
Well, I wouldn't say that that's the story, but it's certainly one of them that ties into maybe a larger component that we could term as the story, which is simply not playing the starters enough and or together. I think in the playoffs, especially when you have a dominant starting unit the way the Hawks do, and for the Hawks, I think what we're seeing for a lot of these less star-filled teams is that you really need all of the pieces in at once to function. You know, if you take out Korver, if you take out Damari Carroll, then all of a sudden not having that star becomes more critical. If you have a star, then you can kind of get away with leaning on them and they can carry the less talented guys. So to me, I think keeping the Atlanta starters together is all the more imperative. I do like what Coach Bud does generally with his reserves, where he plays them in, or with his starters, where he brings back Horford and Millsap in the middle of the quarter to play with the reserves. I think that's a worthy goal to at least not go with an all-bench unit, but you still got to just extend those guys' minutes a little more so you can both play them the first and last 6 minutes of the half with all your starters together, and then also, you know, maybe give them a 3 or 4 minute stint, maybe even 5 or 6 minutes in the middle of the quarter, because the starters just didn't play enough minutes together, and when the starters played, they were great. When they didn't, they got smashed.
Well, yeah, if you want a calibration on that, Kent Bazemore was minus 10, Pero Antic was minus 15, so you can think about the way of bench minutes versus starter minutes in that. While we're talking about the Hawks, Damari Carroll played a fantastic game. He was all over the floor. He was better offensively than I've seen him most of the time, but his defense, his energy was phenomenal.
24 points on 15 shooting possessions for Damari Carroll. Really just an unbelievable game from him. Really an unbelievable playoffs from him. Shooting the ball with his energy, his defense. Really looking like a guy who, it's really a shame for him that he's 29 going on 30, I think is his age. Because if he were younger, you know, if he's 27 right now playing like this, he might even get like pretty close to a max contract. But, you know, now you can't give him that at least that kind of money, at least for long years. But he's someone I fully expect to get at least 8 figures for a couple of years based on how he's played going into his free agency.
Yeah, and the advantage that he has in that sense is that money spent on the current the current salary structure is going to be more valuable later on just because salaries are going to explode. So his agent can make the argument. But the big question with him is, does he want to stay in Atlanta? Because Atlanta is going to have some tough situations, but he has deserved a much larger payday. He's played fantastically during the playoffs. And I would say, would you say he's been the best Hawk so far in the run?
Oh, easily. Yeah, especially when you consider both ends, for sure. We got to talk about how well Washington played.
Yep.
Bradley Beal sprained his ankle, heroically came back. Washington was able to outscore Atlanta down the stretch of this game, and you just kept thinking that the Hawks were going to get it together, but they just couldn't. I mean, the Hawks, again, as we saw it often in the Brooklyn series, especially at the start of the second and fourth quarters, just could not score. The Hawks looked awesome in the first quarter when they had all their starters out there. I think they scored, for most of it, I think they scored 37 points in that first quarter, and then they only had 15, actually they only had 35 in the third and fourth quarters combined. So Washington seemed to kind of figure them out, but a big problem was that they didn't have their starting unit out there, and that was due to Al Horford being in foul trouble, and again, Coach Bud, just as in the Nets series, was really reluctant to play him enough, essentially fouling out his own player well before he would have actually fouled out had he continued to play.
Yeah, and as we've talked about before, what's really devastating in those circumstances is when you basically do the worst-case scenario yourself. And it's that, if you want to talk about the worst case scenario, is that you miss the rest of the game because you foul out. If you pull your guy and have him sit basically the same period of time, then you're not taking the best case scenario, you're not mitigating anything. All you're doing is creating a bad situation that could end up happening, but you're making sure that it happens. And it's correctable, and I thought when Horford played, the Hawks looked so much better. And that's a side effect of having a, if you want to call it, a change of pace backup with him, that Pero Antic doesn't do what Al Horford does. So swapping them out, it's not like you have a let's say, like a downgraded Al Horford. You have a completely different player. And the Hawks didn't have the defensive edge that they have, and the Wizards got a lot of looks, and they played a great game. I'm not trying to knock them at all. They did well, and I'll single out, it was surprising to me, Drew Gooden was making his shots. I thought that was very important for them. And yeah, they had a good team game. I mean, other than Nene dropping kind of a bomb a little bit in this game, the Wizards, top to bottom, played well.
Yeah, one coaching note that was a little odd for Washington, Drew Gooden got his fourth foul early in the fourth quarter, and Coach Whitman took him out. And Drew Gooden was never going to be closing this game. Just leave him in with the four fouls. So what if he fouls out? I mean, and they ended up going to Kevin Serafin, who, surprisingly enough, was pretty effective when he was out there. But interesting that they went with him instead of Nene for those center minutes. Nene was 0 out of 4, did not score, and only played 17 minutes on his own. So telling that Whitman went with Serafin rather than Nene in the fourth quarter before coming back with Gortat. And it's been rather redemptive for Marcin Gortat, who, if you'll recall, was losing minutes closing to Chris Humphreys early in the year when it would be Humphreys and Nene. Now Gortat plays 37 minutes. His pick-and-roll chemistry with John Wall has been outstanding. And Wall had 13 assists in this game. Also, I think, cemented his, with a couple of blocks, cemented his status in my mind as potentially the best shot-blocking point guard of all time. So I can't think of anyone better on that, can you?
No, as soon as I heard you say it, I completely agreed. John, he's a phenomenal athlete, and he has great instincts. One of the things you look for with small guys who are good shot-blockers is that exact thing, that they know where to do it, and he does it a lot as a help defender, which is kind of LeBron does that too at points, but LeBron obviously is not a point guard, and not in that sense of he defends the smallest guy on the floor. And so, yeah, I have no argument with it. He had a good game. It's funny, though. You think about it, and it's like when I was thinking about John Wall, but he did pretty well. He ended up with the worst plus-minus of anybody on the Wizards, though I think that was more about circumstantial, about when he was on the floor. But it is always funny. I'm not a huge on-court, off-court guy when that does happen.
Otto Porter, again, in the small lineup, which the Wizards played a lot of, Porter would this is a little bit of a concern with him, that basically he sits out the first 6 minutes or so of the half each time and then plays the entire rest of the half, is kind of the way it worked out. So that's going to be something to watch, whether he gets tired, but he's got a lot of energy, didn't play a lot during the year, so he seems to be pretty fresh, and he was able to shoot enough again from the three-point line, 2 out of 5, to keep the defense honest. I tweeted during the game, they actually ran some nice 1-4 pick and rolls with him where he was able to space to the three-point line and even shoot that shot, which I was surprised by. I said that his shooting wasn't quite there because the footwork, especially when you come off a pick and pop to shoot a three, is difficult for a lot of guys. It takes a lot of practice. But he was actually able to shoot that shot, and that really opened up the floor again for the Wizards coming down the stretch.
Yeah, he did a nice job. And I don't know, every once in a while I have these Harrison Barnes against the Nuggets flashbacks with Otto Porter, where it's a guy that you didn't really see it during the year, and then you go, oh, okay, you know, you could do that with him. But yeah, I mean, he works out, and I feel like they're getting more comfortable with Pierce and Porter at the 3 and 4, and that will bode well for them almost no matter who they play, as long as they're in the playoffs.
Have we heard anything about Beal's ankle? I haven't heard anything yet.
I haven't heard anything yet, but I will take a look as we continue talking.
Yeah, so I guess that's about it. I mean, we should remember, though, Atlanta just cooled off a ton on their shooting. The Wizards defended better, but Horford was 7 out of 19, missed a lot of his usual mid-rangers. Paul Millsap still not really able to get it going from outside. Korver only 3 out of 11 on threes. So that you expect will improve. Teague, 4 out of 14. Really the only Hawk who shot well among their big minutes guys was Carroll, although he was phenomenal. So I still think that Atlanta's going to take this series. Obviously, if they lose game 2, I won't feel that way. But I feel still okay confident about my Hawks in 6 pick.
Yeah. Oh, so quick Bradley Beal update. The x-ray was negative. They did not need to give him an MRI, and he was walking without a limp. So he should be able to play, and that looks pretty well. But, I mean, you saw it on his face when he went out. I was concerned because of how concerned he was. But
yeah, I mean, there's been a couple of those. Like, Big Baby, too, you thought that he was, like, you know, out for the year or something when he had that injury, and then he was right back playing these last two games. He's looked fine. So, you know, I guess don't judge a book by its cover on some of these injuries. People like to freak out sometimes, but it's always better to wait and see. All right, let's get to the Warriors-Grizzlies. Probably the least amount to say on this series. And the reason I say that is pretty much everything went right for the Grizzlies in this game. You know, Marc Gasol scored really well and efficiently. He had 21 points on 16 shooting possessions. Zach Randolph scored really efficiently as well, 20 points on 16 shooting possessions. They got a ton of offense out of Tony Allen, 15 points. He was making a ton of tough layups off cuts, but able to find room, so you don't expect to get that out of him. And then also the referees were very kind to them, calling a number of dubious fouls to get Andrew Bogut and Draymond Green in foul trouble. Great game for the Grizzlies. They lost by 15 points, and it probably wasn't that close.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to summarize it. And there were also a couple of times in this game, I think it was in the second and third quarters, where Steve Kerr had the substitutes for Bogut and Draymond, respectively, at the table, and they just got those fouls. And so you're sitting there thinking, you know, like that could have changed the complexion of the game. Draymond and Bogut played 27 and 24 minutes, and the Warriors still want it going away. To me, the thing to say with this game, and honestly, it's kind of what we thought we were going to say with the Clippers series, is wake me up when Mike Conley plays. Because I do not, while there's a universe of possibilities, it is hard for me to see the Grizzlies winning a game in this series before Mike Conley plays.
Yeah, it is. And the reason for that is Nick Kolaitis actually was very good defensively against Steph Curry, did one of the better jobs I've seen of any point guard on him. Unfortunately, Kolaitis also scored 0 points in 20 minutes and was 0-4 from the field and 0-2 from the free throw line.
And had two assists. With,
he, which is not very much for your starting point guard in that amount of time. So he and Tony Allen on the floor together, they both started really, really hard to score against the number one defense, especially one that's as smart as the Warriors, that's just going to lay off guys. And the other thing about the Warriors, too, is when the Warriors lay off guys, that doesn't mean that they're just letting them shoot a wide-open three. They might get a shot off, but they're still going to be a pretty good closeout. They're not going to just be, you know, tying their shoelaces and checking the wind before they can shoot. And that's really what a guy like Calathes needs to start making his shots. And he got that against Portland. Not going to get that against Golden State. Beno Udrih does provide some offense, but the problem is that he can't guard Steph Curry to save his life. And whenever he was on Steph Curry, that was a total disaster. Curry just ate him up, and they had to get out of that matchup. It got so bad even that Dave Yeager went with a point guardless lineup with Courtney Lee at the one, or even Vince Carter at the one, and the Grizzlies got nothing out of Carter. He was 1 out of 7 on some pretty tough shots. Marc Gasol admitted after the game in the presser that they basically don't even practice. They've never practiced without a one man, and the communication on both ends wasn't as good as it needed to be based on that. So really tough for Memphis to find a way to both defend Golden State and get enough offense on the floor. I mean, I think the optimal lineup to me would be going with Udrich at the one. Lee and Allen, have those guys guard Steph and Clay respectively, put Udrich on Andre Iguodala or Barnes and kind of live with that. But, you know, that's maybe you can get enough out of that lineup, but that's only one lineup. It can't play the whole game. And, you know, the Warriors are great at exploiting those sorts of things as well.
And something to watch in this series is that the Warriors, and this is a storyline for me as somebody who's covered this team, and to see in a 7-game series that the Warriors are very good. They have a lot of smart defenders at playing passing lanes, and the Grizzlies were throwing passes in this game partially because Mike Conley wasn't there. With kind of, it felt like without the understanding that they were going to get picked off a lot more than in their previous series. And so the Warriors got in this game a lot of easy buckets off of turnovers that probably won't happen as much the rest of the series. And so that will be something to watch in game two, because if Mike Conley doesn't play, and it is uncertain as of when we're recording this, whether he will or will not, whether they can reduce some of those correctable mistakes that were leading to it. I'm not thinking that'll make the difference, but it will certainly make it a closer game each time.
Conley, it was reported today, said that the team said he's still doubtful. Conley sounded a little more confident, said basically that he has now been cleared, at least by the doctors, and it's going to be more of a pain tolerance type of thing. But also disturbing to hear some of his quotes after the game saying that just the noise and the light of being in the stadium during the game was difficult for him. So I don't know whether we're going to see him tomorrow. I think it's tough. I mean, going down 2-0 to this team, you're not going to win the series anyway. But on the other hand, they have 3 days off after this. So maybe he'll give it a go. It's hard to expect. The other thing, too, is he said he just was sitting and he's just been in bed for a week. So if you do that and you're an NBA player, you're going to lose conditioning. He's not going to be in the type of shape needed to play big minutes, even if he is able to go tomorrow.
And the other thing, as soon as I heard the thing about the lights that concerned me and a couple people far smarter than myself on Twitter were bringing this up, is that I started thinking about concussion. And I hadn't really thought about that in relation to what happened, but from what I understand, light sensitivity is a part of that. And I have no idea if he's gone through the NBA's concussion protocols, but if that could be another factor in all this.
Let's see. I mean, I suppose if you're the Grizzlies, your plan might be to just lay off of Andre Iguodala a little bit more. He's still struggled throughout the entire playoffs. Shooting, the Grizzlies only had 7 offensive rebounds. Maybe they can try to hit the offensive glass a little bit harder, especially when Bogut is out of the game. But then if you don't get that offensive rebound, you're in big trouble with Golden State fast breaking the other way. Zach Randolph, I think although he scored well, the Warriors won the battle of space versus post-ups and strength with him, because he just wasn't able to guard Draymond Green outside. Green was 4 out of 8 on threes, a lot of those very early in the game. So it was difficult, and the small lineup for the Grizzlies didn't work. Jeff Green did not play well at all. Not a ton of answers here left for Memphis. I mean, is there anything else that you might try if you were them?
Huh. I mean, are you trying to bait me into saying the thing I said at the end of the game? Because I will say it.
I wouldn't say bait you. I was just...
I'll say it. I think they should play a little bit more of Jordan Adams. I don't think he's the greatest player in the world, and that's not just me being a homer to my alma mater, but I think that one of the ways that the Grizzlies can stay in this series is just by scoring more points. I mean, why I was very skeptical of them winning series is I just didn't think they would score enough. And Jordan Adams is a guy who can do that in spurts, and so I would give him a shot. I mean, to me, the difference between Vince Carter and Jordan Adams in this series is not as large as it would be in other series, and so you give him an easy defensive assignment, as easy as you can get. You hope that he sticks with Harrison Barnes, and you see if he can throw a couple in the net. And I'm not saying you play him starters minutes or anything, but if you gave him 10 to 15 the next game, I think that'd be a good idea, especially if Conley doesn't play.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not going to argue with you that he should get a shot, but I also will say I think it's unlikely that he's going to play well. He's a rookie. Who's he going to guard? You want to put him on Klay Thompson? Not going to work. Obviously, Curry, that's not going to work either. Well, now, you know, if he guards Barnes or he guards Iguodala, then you have two other guys on the floor who are going to be able to guard Curry and guard Thompson. It's pretty difficult when your shooting guard is not going to be able effectively, I don't think. I mean, maybe he can, but I'd like to see the last rookie who was able to guard someone like Klay Thompson in the playoffs effectively. And, you know, maybe he'll provide a little more scoring, but I don't think he's that much better than someone like Carter, where you want to live with the execution downgrade that'll probably result on the defensive end there. But none of these guys are amazing options. Conley, this is another team where we talked about when you don't have that absolute superstar, you need to have all of your good pieces available, and Conley is really the most irreplaceable guy, you'd have to say, on this Memphis roster.
And considering we're talking about the Warriors and we're doing this the day it was awarded, just your quick thoughts on Curry winning the MVP.
I haven't watched his speech yet. By all accounts, it was both touching and amusing. He was my MVP. I wrote a piece on the top 10 players in the NBA, which I've referenced before. I think he is the best player in the NBA right now. And a very, very deserving MVP, based on what he's done. And then, you know, what the Warriors have done as well, though that's a smaller component for me. I don't think there's really much of an argument that there was anyone else who is a better player than him in the league, richly deserved, in my opinion, for him.
Yeah, I definitely think, and we could talk about the nuance of most outstanding versus most valuable. I think he was definitely the most outstanding player, and he earned most valuable over the last couple weeks of the year. Incidentally, in games that the Warriors didn't need to win because they'd won so much early. But yeah, and his speech was great. I was lucky enough to get to cover it, so that was pretty cool. And he's a nice kid. You know, he's one of those that I've been around him since the league. His first games at Oracle were the first games I covered, and he is what it sounds like he is, and he's one of those guys, and I'm happy to see how he has grown. And one of the takeaways for me with him, as somebody who's been around it a long way, is that he is somebody who has worked incredibly hard to get better, and he didn't come into the league as a guy who could run an offense, and that's something he can do. And he is, in a lot of ways for me, he has changed the way that I think about player development. Because he's gotten better at a handle. His passing is flashier, but it is better too. And he's done a great job of becoming the player that he needed to be to really be the best player on a championship team. And that's what he has established this year.
Pretty amazing to think that at one point it was people wondered whether he could actually play the point guard position in the NBA. And now he's the league's best. All right, that's a good one to end on. We will be back tomorrow, at some point we'll be able to record. I'm going to be in New Orleans, but, you know, hopefully I can be able to get away and record again. Let's keep this going. Please give us a rating on iTunes. You can subscribe there as well. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Nate Duncan NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. LEROUX. This is his last name. And we'll talk to you guys tomorrow night. Thanks.